like this man. We all want to change the world. I can't believe.
The White Album's kind of which album?
It's the White Album.
Yeah, it is. White Album.
Yeah. I can't believe. Let's see, Sandy, that had to be 67, 68.
Yep.
What does he know about that?
He doesn't.
He's 21 years old.
Here's something that is kind of weird, and it's something different than we experienced. The music of our youth.
Wait. Maybe we need to come back on first.
Oh.
Officially. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us. He just blows my mind, man. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. Could he have been around at that time?
As a salamander.
Yeah.
Well, a salamander?
Welcome back.
Explain that to me, Sandy.
Reincarnated.
Oh, wait. Let's bring the show back on first. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789 in Texas. That's in them. I wonder if I don't say that, if anything will happen.
Well, sometimes you say that and nothing happens.
It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. All right. Go ahead.
Well, we were talking about albums and 50-year... Well, so the phenomena that I'm describing that is novel is that our youth, the music, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, the rock and roll,
right.
You know, Johnny B. Goode, all that stuff. We're talking about that right now, and everyone on the radio knows what we're talking about because that music survived.
Right.
In 1966, when we were listening to music, we were not listening and or could have talked about music from the 30s. Or the 20s, right? That music had died,
right,
and gone to heaven. And sometimes people want to turn heaven on and listen to the Tommy Dorsey,
right,
or all that old music, but it didn't survive. But the rock and roll of our generation has not only survived but thrived.
Thriving.
And people like Connor know all about it. Know the musicians, enjoy the music, listen to it.
Huh? It's good songwriting lasts forever. You know, that's the thing about a lot of these songs. Like a lot of pop music that I listen to today is really great, experimental on the production side of things. But you know, there's nothing that really gets better than good set of chords and a good melody.
So that's
that's what the Beatles are great at. That's their best asset.
Look, Sandy, there's some uniqueness in this young guy. How many 21-year-olds, even though it still existed, know anything about that?
I think pretty many, actually.
You do.
I mean, nothing like Connor. I mean, Connor's obviously profoundly wise about
you guys are just
just blowing smoke here, Connor?
Yeah. Just constantly.
No,
profoundly.
Man.
Yeah. But I think that music, it's a bit like classical music that, you know, the Bach, Beethoven,
right,
and stuff.
Yeah.
I think that the music of that particular era, and it was the rock and roll of the United States, which was then taken to a new higher level by all of these accomplished English musicians, people who were trained classically in music, who became English rock and roll musicians, college-trained people, you know, and these groups that have taken it to a level that will last a long time.
You know, I was...
And also, just one other thing, the musicians themselves have lasted a long time. So, like, this guy Waters from Pink Floyd is on tour now. Mick Jagger's my age exactly. You know, he's still on tour.
And
still drawing huge
crowds.
Sandy,
what happened to you?
Well, I'm not on tour.
I thought you guys were friends, man. Like,
still drawing huge crowds, though.
You know, Sandy, I wanted to talk about, you and I talked about earlier this week, about Texas requiring In God We Trust signs in schools. They passed the law.
Right.
And only if the signs have been donated. So... clearly, some people came together and created In God We Trust signs. And by law, schools are forced to put those up all over the schools.
Yeah, I mean, it's mandated speech.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, if someone gives you these words written on a sign, you have to put them up. That's weird. That's a very weird. If that withstands that alone, if that withstands constitutional challenge, that would be like saying if someone donates a picture of Richard Nixon, you have to put it up on the wall. Or if someone donates a picture of the sitting president, you must put it up on the wall. But you mentioned that there's a
well, here's a guy who raised $14,000. As of this past Thursday, to distribute In God We Trust signs to public schools across Texas.
Written in Arabic, right?
Written in Arabic.
Yeah.
So, does the school have any option? They put up the Christian, the English In God We Trust signs? Do they have an illegal option to say no?
Well, I mean, I think this is just a terrible direction that has been taken. And the conservatives who think that they're protecting the constitutional right to freedom of religion, it's just upside down, because this is more like the freedom to impose religion, not the freedom to exercise religion. Because what they want to do is impose a religious notion at a public school,
right,
in a sign on people.
A religious
view. So
right,
that, for instance, there might be a municipality in, I don't know where, it doesn't matter what city, that,
right,
might have a predominant number of Hindus. And so they want to have, and they pass an ordinance that says if anyone gives the school a sign that and it expresses some Hindu virtue, it must be put up in the school. And that should go to the Supreme Court in parallel with this Texas case, and there should be a whole bunch of other cases in Dearborn, Michigan, where Islam, I think, would be the predominant religion in all likelihood. You know, you could see that they could want something about Allah put into schools, and of course, the rest of the country would say, "Oh my God, that looks like Sharia law. That's the imposition of religious law." Well, it's no different than what's being imposed in Texas. Why isn't that the imposition of Christian law?
You know, Sandy, all of this points to the inherent danger that is happening in this nation right now with this, you know, Judeo-Christian. That's who we are. We're born under the Judeo-Christian ethic. That's the founding fathers were believed in Judeo-Christianity, and that's who America is. And so we're going to, you know, we're going to force that on the rest of the Americans when, you know, I don't think that's ever been the case that this nation, they say, well, the founding fathers and what they meant and the interpretation of all of those things, and that there was never really a separation of church and state. Well, maybe it wasn't, but clearly we're a better nation when those things are separated, right?
Oh, I think it was, but I think there's no question that separation of church and state was it. It was one of the central beliefs that was central to, first of all, the pilgrims who came to the United States. Almost all of them were seeking religious freedom. Okay. And then that became and going on in the world in the 1700s was a break from the imposition of a particular faith, for instance, Catholicism. And incidentally, until the Reformation, Catholicism was Christianity.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So if you were putting up a sign about Christianity, or you had a view of the Christian view of things, it was Catholicism. And so one of the problems that pilgrims had was that Catholicism was installed through the state in what the state was doing. And that's kind of what's happening when you're putting up signs in schools that appear to be related to this. I mean, it's not a lot different than having the crucifix hung in the school.
You know, Sandy, We have got to get, listen to this. The Arabic text is meant to invoke Islam and some Christians' discomfort with that faith. Stephen said he's hoping for even one school to hang up the poster. In his view, making a point about applying the controversial statute, And if they refuse, he's going to court.
Yeah, of course.
Will he win?
I think he will. I think if the Supreme Court is going to exercise...
You think this can get to the Supreme Court?
Oh, yeah. This is the very kind of case that gets to the Supreme Court, sure. And I think that if our Supreme Court were to exercise itself judicially and with pure judicial, purely a judicial approach to this, they would have to find that statute unconstitutional, the one that mandates the posting of a sign in a school. First of all, I think it's unconstitutional to mandate speech in that manner, regardless of what it is. It would violate the free speech. But secondly, because it's not related to the health and safety and welfare. You know, you can mandate the posting of an exit sign, because that's a matter of public safety. You can mandate other kinds of signage that relates to public safety and health, but you can't just mandate language be posted.
Which is what they did in Texas.
Yes, what they did in Texas.
Which is not going to stand up based on...
Yeah, that shouldn't stand up regardless of whether they even get to the freedom of religion portion of the statute of the Constitution, but it certainly should not withstand the freedom of religion portion either.
You know, Sandy, and I know we've got to go to a break in a minute or so, but I just thought this was fascinating, Sandy, because it does kind of lead to the slippery slope that we're on. People's emotions getting in the way. And so people, what makes them feel, I feel like this is what should happen. And we're responding to what people's feelings are, right?
Yeah.
And not thinking any of that through. The legislature didn't vet this.
Well, it's really all about people trying to hold on to their view of what American culture and values ought to be from their vantage point, and it's really a projection of their own values, okay, and cultural values. And so this is all part of this sense in America, sort of this Christian nationalism, that America is going to change its values from what they believe are dear to what they might otherwise become. It's what Lou from Cudahy was talking about on Monday.
Yeah.
You know, the notion that these people coming across the border are gonna tear at our values, and we've got liberals. He said liberals were essentially against American values, and we're gonna destroy what was important about America.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy, Ukraine, there apparently was a fire or two inside of one of the nuclear facilities on yesterday that kind of scared the bejesus.
Well, it did, you know, but I do know a fair amount about nuclear facilities. When I was a lawyer, I practiced law with electric utilities and did a bunch of work associated with nuclear plants. So here's the story with nuclear plants. They have a cooling facilities that require mechanical energy to move the water through the cooling process. And the electric energy for that cooling process needs to be provided by some source other than the nuclear power plant itself, because it needs to be able to operate
independently.
So when the nuclear plant goes down, you can still cool the core and the water continues to flow. And so there are, going into a big plant like Zaporizhzhia, there are sources of electricity coming into the plant, and it turns out that plant had four different incoming sources of electricity coming from four different power plants around that region. And those lines were destroyed during the war. And the fire that you just spoke to destroyed the last of the lines, so that the four sources of external power to Zaporizhzhia were interrupted. Okay, so they then went into an orderly shutdown of the plant to shut down the nuclear operations, but they needed cooling to continue, and they have diesel backup generators on site. And so the diesel backup generators did operate. They provided the electricity to the cooling, moving the cooling water, which requires far less electricity than the rest of the operations of the plant. And so the plant was never in jeopardy in that regard. Now, if the diesel generators were made dysfunctional, then you'd have a bit more of a problem. But there are, for something like the nuclear plant, there are many, many redundancies built into the way in which protections are afforded, for instance, for the cooling of the core.
But you know, Sandy, you talked about this the other day. There's a war going on.
Yes, and there's no question, with a war going on, That stuff happens, and some of the stuff that happens could include a disaster that would include those backup generators and everything else, in which case Zaporizhzhia could be in jeopardy of some more major failure, with the consequences of the major failure, whether that would be a meltdown and the huge release of radioactivity that comes from a meltdown, or whether it would be something far less than that is harder to predict.
So all I know, Sandy, is you've studied these things, and all I can go by is the things that I've read about Chernobyl over the years, and how
Chernobyl was a meltdown, and Chernobyl was a horrible calamity that spread radioactivity throughout Eastern Europe and Russia, and was a big problem, and remains a problem in the general locale of Chernobyl. There's still radioactivity right there.
Yeah, well, they built basically a cement core around it, and that can only hold it for so long. I mean, whatever is going on inside of it is going to go on ad infinitum. There is no...
Yeah, the half-life of the problem from that kind of reactivity is a very long period of time, and the half-life for at the that's one of the problems with disposing of nuclear waste, is that the half-life of that nuclear waste, meaning how many years does it take to lose half of its radioactivity, and then how many for the next half and the next half, that half-life period is a very extended time period. So it is a long period of time, and there's no question that the United Nations and the world needs to take steps to try and make sure that in periods of warfare, that nuclear power plants are protected against what could be disastrous meltdown consequences.
Well, you know, Chernobyl, nowhere near the size of this plant
right
you're talking about, and still to this day, what they're faced with, and what
this is five plants on one what's called a reservation, right? The site Chernobyl was multiple plants, and I think only one of the Chernobyl plants melted down. So a meltdown of one plant doesn't mean all of them go,
but right,
clearly there is a potential for contagion in that regard. The world is right to be worried about this. It's not quite the Chicken Little kind of a sky is falling proposition at this point, because presumably both sides have serious reasons to be very careful with the plant. But the fact that there is shelling
rockets around it,
there is shelling going on and rockets going on around it, suggests that a bad accident could happen.
You know, Sandy, you referred to it as an accident. You would think that, hey, I don't care if the Russians are there, I'm just not risking shooting, even though they're shooting rockets from there.
Right.
I would say hands off of that site, period. I'm not retaliating. I'll find something else to do, right? I mean, the risk is too high.
Well, that's what the world thinks for sure, and that's what I said. The problem with warfare is that the whole risk-benefit analysis changes, and people in war are willing to take risks because they see a benefit that wouldn't be there without the war going on, and so risks get taken that can be very troublesome.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be back.
Can't keep working like this. This grave shift is like a slave ship.
To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Texas, that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Sandy, Ukraine can launch counteroffensive with new U.S. support, says Key Zelensky. Kiev, Ukraine. Mikhail Podolyak, or whatever, barely flinched as air raid sirens wailed in Kiev, signaling incoming Russian missiles. Sitting in his office at the heavily fortified presidential administration building in Ukraine's capital, the advisor to the head of the office of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the sirens have become a normal part of his life 6 months into the war. We're getting used to this new lifestyle. We are used to wailing sirens now and to the bombardments because the Russian Federation is mostly aiming at the civilian population and civilian infrastructure, he said in an interview with The Hill through a translator. The interview took place on Wednesday. But what we really need to talk about, Sandy, is he's saying we're ready for a counteroffensive. We, United States and us.
Yeah. Well, the same news period here has reported that Biden is now going to provide $3 billion more of aid in military aid to Zelensky and Ukraine, and $3 billion is the biggest number, I think, in one bunch that we've sent them. So clearly, I think the United States is responding to now what is probably viewed as a domestic political pressure to provide continuing massive aid to Ukraine at the same time that Europe is beginning to falter because of the impact of this whole situation on Europe. In not only Germany, but France and all the other countries have scarcity, have a high price for particularly natural gas going into the winter. I mean, if we're watching the day-by-day progress in Ukraine and taking heart some days and saying, oh gosh, it's going the wrong direction this day and now it's really positive. But come the winter, with these sanctions ongoing and with Russia in the position to shut off gas to Europe, Europe is going to be in a very crippled position as the result of that. And the United States was beating its breast about the unity of the NATO allies going into this whole proposition, but it's going to be seriously tested and I think probably cracked during this winter period. So there's a need to have a negotiation and a settlement coming out of this that doesn't seem to be forthcoming. Now, if this $3 billion in aid is really just designed to make sure that Russia comes to the negotiating table, then okay. But the only way they'll do that is if Zelensky's also willing to go to the negotiating table. And the intelligence that's been coming out more recently is that it's the Ukraine that is more resistant to negotiating because they think Russia believes they'll be negotiating from strength, and they want to put Russia on its heels and be in a defensive position before negotiation starts. That's called a war that never ends.
It hardly seems that Russia is willing to kind of negotiate when they're bringing up another 100,000 troops to make their army 1 million strong. I don't care how much we give to Ukraine, they can never have a million man army, right? I mean,
well, Ukraine could.
I mean, Ukraine. What did I say? I don't know. But anyway, but they could, but certainly we're not going to arm the million man army. We can't afford to do that.
Well, that's, I mean, the whole issue here is just how deep are we willing to dig?
Well, we're digging deeper and deeper.
Yeah, and we are obviously digging quite a deep hole. And the war, as it goes on, particularly if the unity of the NATO alliance begins to crack and the willingness of NATO allies to, you know, they've already sent the weaponry that they can expend out of their inventory of weapons rather easily, they've already sent that to Ukraine.
Right.
So the next wave of weapons, just like in the United States, with this $3 billion, they were saying that some of that aid can't flow to Ukraine for until a year from now because they have to put the orders in to make it.
Right.
It's not even in existence yet. What we've been sending to Ukraine to date was the things we already had in our inventory that were ready. It was like the cars on the lot.
Yeah, we're tapping out.
Dealership, okay? And we've sold all the cars on our lot. Now we're like the car dealers we have around Milwaukee that don't have any new cars. You got to order the car.
Right.
Well, that's the way it's getting now for the whatever we're going to be providing to Ukraine is going to have to be on order.
You know, Sandy, the other part of this is the European allies, you know, they're used to struggling and suffering somewhat, but they can turn the thermostat, you know, down somewhat or up, and it down, and during the winter, you know, maybe instead of it being 75, they can turn it down to 70, you know, or turn it up to 70 as opposed to 75.
Mm-hmm.
But they can only do that for so long, and when the real cold, hard reality of the winters come, that's not something you can expect them to do for the entire winter, well, right? There are going to be some bitter cold times.
Well, the kind of shortage they're talking about isn't going to be solved by thermostat settings. Not,
right.
Not for
I know, but I'm saying that's about what the best that they can do.
Right. No, I mean, the real problem is that a shortage of natural gas will spill from heating homes, which there obviously is a requirement necessary to just sustain life, right? So you've
right.
got to provide enough gas to do that. And then when you do that, you'll start shorting the gas that would otherwise be used for industrial purposes, because natural gas is an important fuel used for many manufacturing processes. So when that happens, now manufacturing starts slowing down. So you not only have a recession that's being brought upon you by the huge increases in price in Europe, particularly of energy sources, but you then have a reduction in production that's brought on by a shortage of supply with respect to some fundamental necessary ingredients for manufacturing.
You know, Sandy, I don't want to sound callous, but, you know, the Russians hit a train with missiles yesterday to kill 25 people.
What they fired at apparently was a train station.
Right.
A train station is a vector center for transportation. Transportation is a valid, so long as it isn't purely civilian transportation, is a valid military objective, okay? So this station might well have been located at a vector point for freight transportation within Ukraine. So whether or not this was intended fire at military objectives or whether it was civilian fire is probably a question of vantage point.
So,
if you're a Ukrainian, you cry foul and say it's a military attack on civilians. If you're on the Russian side, you say it's collateral damage that was undesirable and unintended for an attack on a military objective.
So the point I'm making is going back to what you said before we really even got heavily into this. It depends on whose side and who's saying this.
Yes, and one of the problems of news from a war front is that we are getting the news that is strictly pretty much from the Ukrainian side. So we're hearing that there is this civilian target, okay, which was this railroad depot, but maybe that's not an altogether valid. Presentation of it if you look objectively at the circumstance.
So I don't want to get in trouble, but I have this, and I have to say it. So while people are saying those barbarians killed 25 people, and that's a war zone, right?
Right.
Man, in this nation on a nightly basis...
Yeah, we have
hundreds
war zones.
We've got
hundreds of war zones and hundreds of cities.
Yes, but that's not being projected in these mediums.
Yeah,
and that does go to the point that you've been making. So if they keep saying this, well, you know, a rocket hit and two children were killed, then. That's what I'm reading, that's what I'm hearing, that's what I'm seeing, and it's making me more angry, and I'm saying, well, yeah, we gotta make sure we give them more and give them whatever they need with Ukraine. But again, Sandy, we're getting to a point where we're getting ourselves into something we may not be able to get out of, and I don't know if the American people, Sandy, really understand that. As I said the other day, it's not Iraq, it's not Afghanistan. And I don't know if they really have the stomach for what we could be heading into. Because it's going to impact all of us. You know, we think inflation is an issue.
Well, our problem is that we've been able to conduct wars ever since Vietnam in a manner that didn't come home to roost at home,
right.
Other than with returning servicemen and the problems they had.
Right.
But so, you know, it didn't bring us inflation. It didn't inflict on the rest of the world all the kind of problems that are currently being experienced as the result of this war. And so this is the first real war. Okay, that we've been involved in. Those other actions were sort of localized, and we could conduct them without otherwise feeling the impact of it in the United States, and it was also not experienced in Europe and the rest of the places. Those were more like military adventures. This is not a military adventure. What has happened here is something that's much more troublesome and much harder for anybody to escape, and. Mark my words, if we don't change our course with respect to Taiwan, what could happen out of Taiwan dwarfs, absolutely dwarfs, what is currently happening as a result of Ukraine. And we better carefully measure the actual strategic interest we have in Taiwan much more carefully than we have measured the actual strategic interest we have in Ukraine before we get involved.
You know, Sandy... what's going on in Ukraine and Russia is what the world has been trying to avoid since World War II, right? I mean, since World War II. That's what we've been trying to avoid. Right? I mean, the world.
Well, yeah, exactly. But and the my problem is that, like I said, this we didn't follow real politics. We didn't follow geopolitical realities. We decided that hegemony was something that was only could only be exercised by the United States, and everyone else should be ignored, which is what we're currently doing in the South China Sea and with China, and it's what we did with Ukraine and Russia. And by doing it, we have essentially we're stirring the pot, okay? And we can say, oh, this is unprovoked aggression. It's not unprovoked aggression. It's Newtonian reactions. You know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And we've been indulged for the last 20 years. We've been indulging in ever more adventuresome actions out there in the world, exercising our muscle and our hegemony, and in the face of, for instance, China, which is a rising power. So their ability to calmly absorb the way we're conducting our international affairs in the year 1995 is far different than their willingness to absorb it today.
So you can't measure. And maybe that's what some people in this nation are doing, measuring our nuclear power compared to China's, which there's no comparison if we're talking about nuclear power, our nuclear weaponry, and China's nuclear. Weapons that we have.
I mean, nuclear warfare has obviously a catastrophic, apocalyptic outcome. Short of that, warfare that doesn't involve nuclear weapons looks and feels much more like the Ukrainian war, which has a devastating effect.
Sandy, hold the thought. We got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You're tuning into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Let's go to the phone lines, man. Who do we have on the phone line?
Good morning.
Hey, Dave from Mech One. Hey, Dave, what's going on?
Okay, Earl. How are you doing? How are you doing, Sandy? Really quickly, in regards to all this, I do think we are headed to World War III, and I'll tell you why. If you look at what China has, obviously Taiwan has been part of the conversation now for a while, but it should be also noted that Japan now is starting to gear up as well, because they've been firing ships and planes and everything to Japan, and they also threatened last year, China did, some very high diplomatic officials of blowing Australia off the map. And Australia now is talking about ramping up their military. And so I think, and if you look at what China is doing, they're building all sorts of new Navy ships right now, as we're speaking, to compete with the United States Navy for a huge battle, and they made that very clear that they're going to do what they have to do, and I predict that is coming around the corner much more sooner than later. And to Sandy's point, if we do get involved in a situation like that, that is just going to make the Ukraine situation look like very small in comparison as far as a battle is concerned. And I should also mention that in World War II, if you look when the reason why we used nuclear weapons against Japan was the amount of people that would have lost their lives to invade Japan would have been astronomical. That being said, the loss of life in Japan was actually greater when we bombed Tokyo with all the traditional bombing. A lot of people died in fires and and explosions, much more than even the actual
Dave, in fact,
the nuclear bombs.
Yeah,
yes,
you're dead on about that. Although one of the problems of that was that our bombing of Tokyo was a firebombing, and the bombing of and Dresden and a number of other areas. So, as far as the Geneva Accords were concerned, those were all abandoned somewhere during World War II by both sides, including us. And so that certainly the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima as well were civilian targets. So you know the horror of war is that ultimately the rules of war get thrown out, and we throw them out as well, so we can't be too sanctimonious about it. The second comment I would make is that we, you know, we all look at the buildup of the Navy in China and believe that it necessarily portends disaster, but what has the world thought of the fact that we have a huge Navy at a time when no one else has a Navy that's large enough to deal with us? Don't you think that they feel threatened by the fact that we not only have a huge Navy, but we have naval bases on every continent, on every sea, on every ocean, and we exercise naval exercises off of every one of those bases quite regularly. So the rest of the world is certainly in a position to think that we, America, are in a position to exercise extreme power over them from a military standpoint. And so the fact that China might be trying to get parity with us should not necessarily mean that we're headed to a conflict. We could just be headed to a détente, right? We both have power. We both realize we have power. We're less likely to use it because we both have it. And so, to me, the real problem is that we're elevating Taiwan's independence to an artificial state because, number one, we have a treaty that says it isn't independent. We have an international foreign policy that agrees that it's not independent. We've left unresolved to strategic ambiguity. The question of exactly what its status is, and now we're letting Congress people and domestic politics start to rule the day with respect to what our international policy would be. And that would be fine if we had a domestic politics that was highly reasoned and very sophisticated about the interest of the United States in the Pacific, but that's not what we've got.
Are you referring to the Taiwan Relations Act in 1979 as far as...
Under Carter, that treaty that we agreed, we specifically agreed that there was a one China. And we didn't, and we left unresolved the status, what the exact status of Taiwan was, but we agreed that there was but one China and that Taiwan fell within the one China principle.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But in that same treaty that was passed by Congress, by the way, that was also meant to be where China would be peaceful towards Taiwan, and it
But that's like the United States agreeing to be peaceful to Texas. under that treaty, the view was that the Kuomintang was no longer the alleged government of all of China, and in fact the Communist Party was the government of all of China. And then the question was, you know, I guess, would they invade Texas or not? I mean, that kind of that peaceful language was kind of superfluous in the context of us agreeing that it was theirs. They didn't need to invade it. They wouldn't need to invade it unless, for instance, Taiwan armed itself and put it in a position of having a militia that would permit it to be to assert its independence. Just like if Texas developed an air force and a navy and an army. Now, what Taiwan is doing right now is we're maybe agreeing to sell them a whole bunch of military equipment, more military equipment, so they can become more armed. And for the first time, starting in 2019, the Taiwan government has begun to talk about separatism. So that would be a bit like Texas agreeing to take its marbles and leave the United States. Under Robert
Lee. What are your thoughts about what Japan and Australia reconsidering? Doing a massive military buildup. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, they're doing it in the context of an alliance with the United States and the Southeast Asia military alliance. It's all part of flexing their muscle vis-a-vis China. All of that muscle flexing does maybe increase risk, but it also maybe increases diligence about not having the war that could result from that kind of military confrontation. And the danger is that we would decide foolishly that we ought to have such a huge military confrontation over Taiwan when we resolve that issue, and if we would have been better off to leave it resolved and let it reside quietly within the domain of China.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Be right back.